Hi everyone, this is Gary Barkalow. The podcast that you are about to listen to is actually a campfire conversation that we did inside of the Noble Heart Base Camp. Base Camp is an online membership community for those who have gone through a calling event where they can come and resupply, recalibrate, and reorient their life for the journey that they're on with God. And they're walking into their calling. So we wanted to give you a taste of some of the things that go on inside of Base Camp. We know that you will enjoy this conversation with Wayne Jacobson. If you want to read more about Base Camp, go to the NobleHeart.com website and look for the page called Base Camp. Enjoy the podcast.
Hi, everyone. This is Gary Barkalow, and with me is Jeff, and we have a pretty special campfire conversation this time. We're talking to somebody outside of Base Camp, and this is Wayne Jacobson, and a new friend of mine and a friend of Jeff. And so, Jeff, I'm going to let you introduce him and kind of introduce the direction and the content of the call and let you go forward on that.
Okay, great. Hey, guys. In so many of the intensives that we have done, when it comes to tell us your three favorite books, so often we'll see the shack show up there, and when the guys begin to open that up, they tell how that book has impacted them. Or sometimes under their three favorite speakers, you'll also see Wayne Jacobson if they've listened to the transition tapes. And so just with that in mind, we wanted to have him on thinking that he has had such a profound effect on so many of our lives. And we've met before, Wayne and I. That was a fun meeting, actually. One day I was sitting at my computer, and I stood up. I'm by myself, and I said, okay, that's it. I'll call him. And I go in the other room, and I make a phone call. Dana hears me say this. I'm talking to myself, and she says, what are you talking about? And I'm, you know, I just feel like God wants me to call this guy. So I called him, and sure enough, he actually answered his phone. And,
hey, don't tell people that. Don't tell people that.
Yeah, I was surprised, too. Remember, I asked you, I said, Wayne, what are you doing answering your phone?
That's right.
You said, well, whose phone am I supposed to answer?
That's right.
And so anyway, we started this conversation, and what I really enjoyed was sort of talking about the shack, talking about God, and talking about history. Do you remember, Wayne, you were watching the John Adams series at that time?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was God, history, and the shack, and it was just a wonderful conversation, great relationship, and that began to form over the phone. And, of course, he's always wanted to see Monticello, and sure enough, he comes out probably a couple months later, and we hosted Wayne and Sarah here, and we actually met up at Monticello, I think, right? Or Mickey Tavern, which is right by Monticello, and then we got to take you up there and see that, right?
Yep.
So that's pretty much how it all started for us, and so we just wanted to have him call in tonight. Tonight is my birthday. I am 53 today, so just wanted to give you the rules of engagement tonight, Wayne. If the conversation is not going well or you're picking on me or Gary's picking on me, I just raise my hand and say it's my birthday, right? And
well, I can't see if you raise your hand.
End of conversation. At that point, everybody goes back to their corner, and we could start a new conversation there, right?
Oh, really?
But
all right, we'll be nice to you, Jeff. Okay. By the way, Wayne, I posted your telephone number on Facebook, so you'll be a very popular man.
I appreciate that. Very great.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
But, hey, listen, me and Wayne do have one date in common, and that is May 17th. What's that, Wayne?
That's my anniversary.
So it's mine, too. Yeah.
We didn't get married to each other, so let's be clear.
Yeah, we share the same anniversary. I am. What are you, 35 years or something like that?
Coming up on 36.
I'm 25. This year will be 25.
You're just
I feel like I'm already going to blow it, you know. I know it's an important one. I don't know what it is. Is that a diamond anniversary or something, or gold? But whatever it is, I feel like I'm already going to blow it, you know.
See, we treat each other like it's our anniversary every day. Then we don't run into those problems.
I just wanted to start us out by saying, first of all, congratulations on reading Les Mis. I was reading your blogs there and saw that you read the book.
Yep.
1,400 pages?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And so how was that compared to sort of seeing the play or actually seeing the movie?
The experience is obviously totally different. There's so much more, as anybody knows, in a book than they can ever get in a movie or a play. That whole transforming experience of grace, and whether you're going to live in the world of law or whether you're going to live in the world of grace, and it's even more amazing read than either the movie or the play, which we both loved. So,
yeah, I remember I read the first, I think, 270 something pages because it dealt primarily with the priest, and I was fascinated with him when I read or saw the movie.
Yep,
and it was so interesting because you're learning things that there's no way they can cover in the book. But what was so interesting about the priest was that he was born into aristocracy, if I remember right, and then really kind of sold out to serve those people in that village. And he was actually looking for a way to get rid of those candle lamps, those candlesticks. They were the one thing left from his life, from his old life. And he was actually looking to give him away when Jean Valjean comes in.
Yep.
And, so just an extraordinary story. Best date in my life was taking Dana to London, actually flew her there on a trip, and we saw the play at the Palace Theater. And I was reading on your blog, did you actually see it there in London?
We saw it in London at the Queen's Theater, yeah.
At the Queen's Theater, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was absolutely beautiful. And when Fontaine got on the floor there and sang her song on her knees there, I Dreamed a Dream, that was it for me. I just broke down. I couldn't believe it. What a powerful song that was.
Yeah, and in the book, I tell you, the whole last 100 pages or so of Jean Valjean's relationship with his surrogate daughter and this new son-in-law and why he did what he did, those things aren't fleshed out in either the movie or the play. And it was worth reading the entire 1,400 pages to read the last 100. So,
yeah, that's interesting. So can you open that up a little bit of what he did? I'd be really curious to know, actually.
I wouldn't even try and capture it right now, just sitting here trying to remember it. But just the way he loved his son-in-law by stepping back from the relationship because he didn't trust him. And he didn't want to come between his daughter and her husband, and so he took a back seat to some things that were going on there. Again, a giving of grace, giving up the relationship that was so important to him, so that his son-in-law could have an opportunity to build that same relationship. And, it was pretty powerful.
Hmm.
That continued giving up, the whole nature of the kingdom, I think we miss this. The law is always about grabbing everything you can for yourself.
Hmm.
And Jesus talked about greater love has no one than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. And as I understand, part of Base Camp is all about connecting relationally. And I think the reason why people in general, men specific, have a hard time really capturing the beauty of a relationship is because we always begin relationships with what can I get out of this instead of how do I lay my life down for someone else?
Hmm.
How do I give up something to be part of it? And that, to me, what comes out of Les Mis is that whole law is grabbing for yourself, and if you grab, I have to grab. And same thing's true in marriage. If my spouse is grabbing stuff, then I've got to grab stuff. But if we're both giving up to each other, if the language of Paul, I think, if we both are outdoing one another and doing good, those are the best days in our marriage when Sarah's just, we get in these little competitions. She does something nice for me, and I've got to get something better for her, and then she does something better for me. And just the niceness just grows all day till we finally exhaust ourselves. But it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun living in that kind of a relationship.
I had an opportunity to speak to all the counselors that do the pregnancy centers here in Virginia. And they just wanted me, for some reason, to talk about the heart of a woman. And I showed the scene from Les Mis, actually. And it's a scene where Jean Valjean comes in and rescues Fontaine. And from the law, Joubert is just what a picture of the law he is in that movie. And
yep.
He then takes her home to clean her up. And she's laying on the bed there, and he comes to her, and he starts to unbutton her just to clean her up. And she goes, go ahead, you deserve this. And she's so in her eyes, she's just a prostitute. And the idea was, okay, you saved me, so now I serve you. And then he corrects her right there and says, no, actually, that's not where we're going with this relationship at all. Let me tell you who you are. And that you are a beautiful woman, and always have been a beautiful woman, And so there's this theme in there, this beautiful theme of, you know, no, it's not about I save you and now you serve me. And so it's a really great point to kind of stop and talk to the women about that, about, you know, and I think that's fallen so heavily on the women, especially in the church today, is this idea of service.
Yeah.
And that when you look at it, you know, from a distance, they could look very tired, actually, you know, of, okay, that's what I'm into this relationship for. And so awesome, awesome movie.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Okay, so one of my favorite lines from when you were out was this idea where you said an elder is a person or a man who has lived enough of his own life and passions and is now ready to give himself a substantial amount of time to someone else to help them find their passion in life. And if I would ever able to introduce to you all the guys that are listening in on this, I'd say that's probably the guys that you're talking to. A lot of kind of elder guys have walked with God for a while. A lot of them are maybe somewhat, you know, not in an institutional environment, that sort of thing, and walking along. But I'd love to know, where did you get that from, that verse? And I just, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I don't know where I got it from. Just one of the things that came out one day when I was talking to a group of folks, we were talking about what eldership is. One of the other things they say about eldership is, elder is the person you want to go to if you're going to be caught in your worst moment. They're the person, you know, will love up on you, give you grace, but give you honesty too, and help you make next steps to find freedom. So that's one of the things we were talking about, and then we kind of got into that second thing about you know, they've lived enough of their passion. They've really fulfilled their vision. I think the popular notion of eldership today in the body of Christ in many places is it's a man with a vision, and everybody comes along to serve that vision. And I really think it's exactly the opposite of that. An elder, and I'm not just specific to men here, it can also include women, are people that have, you know, I've done what God's put me on the planet to do. I've gotten a chance to do a lot of that, and I don't need to live in the pressure to fulfill myself. It kind of gets back to that theme again of grace, of now, how can I help you do what God's called you to do? How can I help you recognize and see and feel free to flow with it and go on and be part of it? So.
That's good. Gary, you got? Are you listening in there?
Yeah, I sure am. I sure am.
Yeah, that's good. An elder is the guy that when you're in your worst moment, you want that guy there, right?
Yep.
That's a whole turn on that word for us, I think.
That's the man you would go to rather than that's the man you would run from. I mean, that's stirring. That's
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think so many of us, you know, look at God that way, as if he's sitting there waiting to catch you in your worst moment, so that therefore he can there punish you. You know, just that whole idea of, you know, who God is in so many people's eyes.
Yeah, that'd be the first reality, wouldn't it? I mean, if we don't want God to catch us in our worst moment, then we're probably not going to find a real elder. We're going to find somebody that just kind of, you know, props us up in a fleshy kind of way. But if we really know God's the safest lap to fall into when I'm messing up in some wonderful way, then you are going to find the right people to help you out at times when, you know, you just need somebody to be there to understand in a way that's redemptive, not just excuses and brushes it under the rug, but really is redemptive in what God does going forward.
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting to me because, honestly, that's where I see more of the kingdom of God happening here today. You know, I think it's more one-on-one, two guys talking, three guys talking here or there, digging into a person's life, going after their problem, really praying with him about it. And then, like you're saying, help him in that situation. You know, even sometimes it's helping him into what he should be doing or what he's called to do, coming alongside of him. Honestly, from where I'm sitting, that's where I see the kingdom of God gaining the most and where it's happening around us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Wayne, let me ask you, when you're speaking conversing, writing, podcasting, what are you finding is the primary way this, you know, legalism, this religiousness, all this is kind of hitting the body of Christ? I know it's coming in 500 directions, but what seems to be the primary thing that you're seeing running into experiencing?
Bottom line to me, it's just the manipulation of our guilt or our fears, whether it's about God or the future or life. Legalism runs off the mistaken notion that we can control our lives by doing things God's way and then manipulating God to do things our way, beginning to do what we want him to do. And so legalism isn't always a disgusting message. It's very seductive at times. It's promising some real freedom in life, but it's doing it in a way that undermines the promise itself. In the more stringent way, it's the whole performance ethic of, you know, some young lady. I was in a home in Chicago visiting a man who's a good close friend of mine. His wife had passed away with breast cancer a year or so before, and he was raising two teenage daughters on his own, and they'd been off to youth group that night, and they came back from youth group, and they were running up the stairs laughing, and Dad said, "Hey, girls, how was youth group tonight?" And one of them, the younger one, ran back down, halfway down the stairs, poked her head underneath the ceiling, and said, "Well, Dad, you know, same old, God's good, you're bad, try harder." And, doggone, that's what most people labor under. It's the, if I could just get this right, if I could just, and there's no end. Even if you are doing some things well, then the question is always invoked, are you doing enough? Are you reading your Bible enough? Are you praying enough? Are you witnessing to the lost enough? And that whole performance treadmill, which on the one hand is so rewarding if you think you can do it,
mm-hmm.
and on the other hand, so destructive when you can't. And of those two people, here's what I think is true of the whole religious performance treadmill, and that's this. It's most dangerous when you succeed. I think the thing we find in the New Testament overwhelmingly true is the only thing God regards more dangerous than unrighteousness is self-righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Paul said, "I don't be found with that at all. My righteousness needs to come by a growing trust in who he is, not in my performance or my ability to draw it out of my human effort." And, you know, we all labor under that lie that we could just try harder, do better, and God would do something more in our lives. And it's very captivating and very destructive.
Yeah, so, I think much so Wayne, more so than we – go ahead, Gary.
Okay, so Wayne, how would you differentiate a person's desire to excel at something, to grow, to offer, to be more from this, you know, I think I can reach the standard. I think, you know, I can make it that way. How do you, obviously that's an issue of the heart. How would you help a person distinguish between those two things?
Yeah, I loved your saying it's a deal in the heart, so it's not as easy to measure by something external. I mean, you could look at a few things and say, are you feeling pressured to this? There's one thing about trying to excel and working hard because you're afraid of something or you feel like you should or there's some guilt involved. That's one kind of hard work and labor. The other that comes from a profound sense of vision and excitement, and I'm up till 3 o'clock in the morning working on something, not because I have to, but because I'm horribly excited about what this is and I want to make it the best that it can be. And Paul was nuts about each of us learning to cease from our own labors and not try to do this thing on our own and not have any confidence in human effort. And yet in Colossians 1, Paul is saying, I labor and strive more than any man to fill up in you what might be lacking of the work of Christ. So I think we're talking about the difference between human effort based out of fear and trying to impress my friends and wanting people to think I'm spiritual and all those motives that have us pressured into doing something, and then the joyful invitation into something, which I think people work twice as hard at, something they really love and enjoy,
right,
and they have a vision and a passion for. So mm-hmm. it's not a matter, it's not a degree of work. It really is the motive, where it's coming from, and what do I feel pressed in this, or do I feel invited into this?
Mm-hmm.
I think that,
yeah, that's
one of the things Paul uses in Romans 12 is that difference between there's conformity in the world, which is to pressure us from the outside, and the other thing is the transformation of the spirit through the renewing of the mind, which is something that grows out of the inner person. So it's not the – and I think religion for 2,000 years, we've chosen to use pressure. We'll press people into conformity. We've been content with that. So people really think that's God when they feel pressured to do the right thing. instead of realizing that the conformity process is a foreign process to this kingdom. Being pressed to do anything for God is a horrible, horrible reality, and it is ungodly at its root. And so then people can learn, okay, now how do I live in the freedom of being invited to and transformation, and God is at work in me to will and to do of his good pleasure? And all that rises from a very, very different place in our hearts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me with that ask you a question that was put up on the forum to ask you when the call happened, but this was ahead of time. And this is from John Hard, and he starts by a quote that he said he got from the heading of a recent God Journey podcast, the one titled, "We've Got to Do Something." So let me read the quote. I want you to react to it. He said, "As we begin to learn to live in the Father's love, it is easy to feel like we're not doing enough. Religion kept us busy and gave us validation for the meetings we attended and the activities we were involved in. What happens when that slows down and we don't have any commitments to fill our lives? At that point, our flesh can begin to scream, but we have more to do. We have something to do. Probably more fruitless activity have begun from that timeless cry than from any other motivation, and invites us to put confidence in our flesh rather than live in what God is doing around us." Now, okay, he kind of wants to put that quote against a quote of mine, so to be fair to John, I'll throw that up because I was going to not do this.
Okay.
But, so this came out of an article that I posted, and I wrote, I'm going to read the quote now, I don't know that I'd remember it. "Many people begin the pursuit of their calling by looking for a cause that they can give themselves to, and eventually find themselves living a life that is far from their desires of their heart. It is unhelpful to start with a cause. We must instead pursue the discovery and development of the glory of our life." So, so why don't you say a little more about that quote, and I realize you just were, but maybe just expand a little farther with your quote.
Well, I think we say it so well there, Gary, it just doesn't need to be more embellished on, both yours and mine. But
man, I like you.
There's just so many ways that I think the world manipulates us. The need for significance, the need to have a cause, as you would say it here, or that drive, well, we've got to do something. And religion is notorious for taking the tools of the world, and because it thinks it uses them to better ends, it's going to get a better result. And I know so many people involved in this journey, learning to live love, learning to live inside the Father's work instead of participating in all the religious structures that have just, you know, brought us into some kind of substitution of a relationship for the practice of ritual or following rules. And that drive, just because we come to a different reality doesn't mean those drives go away. The reason why the world uses them and the reason why religion uses them is because they really appeal to something in all of our flesh. There's something in our flesh that does want to be significant. I want to be part of a bigger cause than myself. And when I watch people go on this journey, very quickly in the journey becomes the opportunity that someone will offer them to fulfill whatever their passion is in some kind of cause or some kind of human effort-controlled environment, because people are always wanting to use our gifts and talents for whatever they think they're best for. And early on, I think we have to decide. And I, our little title to the podcast, which I wrote, was kind of looking at people who go on this kind of the out-of-the-box journey, and the next thing is, well, we've got to do something. So let's form a Bible study, form a group, form a house church, form a new congregation in the area, form something. And don't let happen what I think needs to happen first, which is, why don't you become friends with each other, genuine friends, before you try and start any kind of meeting that's going to put an overlay of an it between you instead of, no, we're going to grow to become friends, and as friends, we're going to learn to listen to God together. And then God's going to begin to initiate some things that he wants to do among us that's going to be very different from what anybody else is doing on the planet, most likely. And we get to go into a very different journey when we're not constrained by these external fleshy desires, but instead stop back and say, you know what, I don't have to join a cause. I don't have to do something. In fact, I think God would be better off with us doing nothing than anything we're going to do out of our own human effort. Most people forget that Jesus spent 90% of his life doing what most of us do every day. Getting up, eating, drinking, doing the responsibilities, learning to be a carpenter. It was 30 years old before he had ever healed a person, taught a sermon, did anything that we seem to value as godly stuff. God was inhabiting common life and making himself known the way Jesus treated his mom and brothers. It's likely his father passed away in his childhood, and Jesus is going to be the miracle worker, healing all kinds of people. He's not doing that when his dad dies. And so we've got God ennobling not the ministry part of our lives, but life. God no more present at a meeting of brothers sharing scripture than he is on our job during the day, a plumber that can't get a fitting to work and say, God, what am I missing here? Help me. That God wants to be no more present in our so-called sacred moments as he is in life in general. When we learn to live there, then I think we find that the whole need for a cause, need to do something, gets consumed in this greater desire to just, hey, I'm going to go with what God's doing in my life today. I'm just going to follow that and see where that takes me, which is often to some places your own head would never get to or your own effort would never even think to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And yet so, be so much
so what,
better.
What is it then that blocks a person or confuses or distracts or dissuades a person from just kind of going with that thing that's in their heart to do versus, you know, going to the voice that says, this is what you ought to be doing, this is what's expected of you? What are we up against?
I heard you ask that. Everything. Everything goes the other way. Everything drives us toward, you know, our friends will, our boss will at work, our partner in business, our religious club. Everything is going to say, God's already told us what to do. You just do the best you can, and you just get people into the doing before they've simply learned to be God's child in the earth and to be loved. And when Paul in Colossians starts talking about doing, he starts from therefore. As God's children, holy and dearly loved. That's where you start the doing. And we've never gotten people into that reality first. We think we can work our way into that. And so the lie of religion is, I'll work hard to get to the thing I want instead of, I need to relax into the reality of who God is. Get in touch with the real core of who he's made me to be. Watch him untwist what the world and sin and even religion has done to make me an achiever and think my significance resides in my performance or my achievements, now I'm ready to begin to live life. And so everything goes the other way. That's why I think the conversations we have with other brothers and sisters needs to be this conversation. We need to be the voices that invite people away from the lies and the illusions of self-control and back into the reality of learning to live in the love of a father. And you can trust him. He has got your heart in mind, and he will work in you. And by relaxing into him, we get in touch with our real heart, rather than fighting our way to him by the accomplishing of things.
Yeah. Jeff, I have a question that came up in the chat box. Would you like me to ask that now, or do you have something?
I think we've lost Jeff.
Okay, anyway, so the question is this. This is such a great question. Now, this is very personally to you, and the question is, Wayne, living inside the Father's work, which you talked about, and the question is, how does that look like for you day to day? What do you do? How do you live your life?
Literally, truthfully, honestly, wake up every morning at some point early in the day, I'm just saying, Father, what's in front of me today? What's on your heart for me? What are you giving me today? And then I live with my eyes open. Sometimes there's things left over from the day before. If there's a book I'm working on, or there's a project, or I'm getting ready to set up travel somewhere, you know, sometimes things carry over from the day before, but other times it's just, and I don't get an agenda sheet from God. I don't get an email from him saying, here's what I want you to do. But there are things my heart begins to be drawn towards. There's a name that keeps running around my head to maybe call and have lunch with. There's someone else to write an email to. There's, you know, just a way to love Sarah today, my wife, because I promised her when I married her. I didn't just promise I would be sexually faithful to her until I died. I promised I would cherish her every day of my life. So I look for a way to cherish her that would make sense in her world and let her know that I love her. And she's important to me. And so, the practicality, I know people go, that doesn't seem very practical to me. It's incredibly practical to say, okay, God, I give this day to you. My prayer life used to be, here's the 15 things I want you to do today, God, and most of which you never did. And now the agenda is pretty simple, saying, God, what are you giving me today? And that actually derives in my life from a scripture, Matthew chapter 6 and Luke 12, from the Sermon on the Mount that Eugene Peterson translates in the Message, and Jesus is talking to disciples. He says, what I'm trying to get you to do is to relax and not be so preoccupied with getting that you can't respond to God's giving. And I think religion taught me how to get. Even though it didn't work, it taught me, you know, how to get my prayers answered, how to get fellowship I need, how to get my ministry, how to get. The last 15 years, I've been learning to live inside what God gives today, which is simply I ask him. And then I look for his fingerprints in my day. I look for a conversation that suddenly just seems to have grace on it. I look for a project. If I'm writing or, you know, I got a host of emails to look at, I'm going to those emails and goes, where's the grace to respond to this person or that person today? So they're really, and it's not as contrived as some people might want to make that. I don't pray about brushing my teeth. I don't pray about what I'm going to have for breakfast. I don't, you know, it's not a contrived thing. It's just a reality of I can live today inside the Father's work. And when I see, this is I think Paul's prayer of the Colossians chapter 1, when I see what God's doing, then I know what my part's going to be. And if I don't know what he's doing, then I'm just going to be running around like the proverbial chicken with its head cut off trying to do something to make God notice me. So it is that relaxing. And what I'm talking about now, it probably takes 2 or 3 years to learn this. I'm not saying it's something, I'll just go out and do that tomorrow. It's a journey of saying, God, teach me to live in your working instead of my anxieties or my responsibilities or whatever else that seems to motivate someone.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Gary, I'll
yeah,
ask.
Go ahead.
Hey, from the Jake book, it was great in there because you talk about church a lot. And there was a reference in there that, you know, that Christ really didn't look at the church as a place that we go to or something that we do, but a reality that we live in every day. And that's what I love about this message that I've been hearing is just the validation of being able to get up in the morning and go, hey, all right, Lord, what are you doing today? And I think that's the problem I have with the institutionalized church. It's not so much the things that happen there, but they're, you know, it just seems like a few guys have the keys to this thing who are determining what's going to happen, and that this is church. This is what church is. It's a place. And the message there is that, okay, well, then when I leave there, I've left church, and I'm pretty much on my own for the next 6 days here, you know. And what's been fun is looking at people's lives and validating what they do and going, do you understand, do you see what you're doing here and how you're interacting with God? And a perfect example today is I went to a guy, because it was my birthday, got a massage. It was wonderful. The guy's an artist. He's an elder at this local church I used to be at. And, you know, I never really saw what he did there, but on the table, the guy is an artist on how he knows the body and where the pain is and how he relieves it. And then he talks with you and he prays with you. And I'm like, okay, dude, this is your life. This is your, you know, what you're called to do. This is what, you know, how you're giving God away. And so it's the, it's sort of this validation of the rest of their life that it's not a particular day or a particular hour, but that it's your life.
Yeah. And religion doesn't always do that intentionally, but I do think the idea of creating sacred space, there's, you know, sacred meeting place or sacred day, there's a Lord's day, or, you know, the Lord's house is our house. The Lord's day is this day. I think we need to lose that sense of sacred space, and I think that's what the whole cross was about. Jesus, when he served the bread and the wine at the Last Supper with his disciples, It really was to invest his presence, not in a building, a holy of holies somewhere, but in the most common things we eat every day, the cup we drink and the bread we eat. I'm not even sure it was meant to be this little ceremony we do with a little wafer and a shot glass in church. I really wonder if what he meant was when you sit down at your table tonight and you break bread, you have a sense that God is at this table with us. God's come to make our home his home. God's come to make our life his life. And all of us get to be participants in that reality. And what you said, the other side is our sacred people, people specially gifted to get the stage and the lights, and everyone else is reduced to spectator time. And I don't know if that's always true of traditional congregations. I was in one this Sunday speaking that where people do live in a great dynamic of church. Church is not this meeting. We have a meeting once a week, but this is not church. Church is the relationships we have with each other and how we walk together and love God's people and how that plays out all week long, not just at a Sunday morning event.
Okay, so my question is, what about the youth in our country? It just doesn't seem like, I've heard it said we're the last generation here of the way things are going traditionally with church. But you're really, I think there's a lot of youth out there that love to talk about God, and they will acknowledge him, and they want nothing to do with going to church on Sunday morning. But yet they're very relational. They'll sign up for bike tours. They'll sign up for, kickball events, anything to get. They love being with people. And yet, I don't know. I'm just kind of asking you, what do you see there or in the way of transition, what's going on in our country with the youth?
Well, it's not just our country. I was in Germany a couple of weeks ago, and a big question I had, the one traditional kind of church group I spoke to, the biggest question they had was, youth aren't coming here. Youth are leaving here in droves. We have no youth, and that's a growing, it's 700 people, which in Germany is a huge, huge fellowship. And they're saying, where's youth? Why aren't you? I go, why would youth be engaged with this? Look
right
at what you're doing.
Right.
This is a centuries-old delivery system. It's not even getting to the whole religious versus relationship kind of issue. It's an older, that our generation understands and can appreciate, and the younger crowd is not. But look how we've inculcated them to it. I pulled a few articles out of the newspaper around here last Easter time where somebody's doing an Easter egg drop from a helicopter and somebody else was doing something else to try and attract people to their building on Sunday morning. And what we're saying by just even the practice, I understand why people do it, but the whole idea of we're going to drop Easter eggs and that's going to get kids more engaged in what we're doing says you don't have a Jesus real enough to engage kids. You've got a Jesus less real than dropping Easter eggs out of a helicopter into a football stadium. And that's what's sad. What youth really want is to be engaged with a real God who makes himself known to them in a real way, and they begin to have this spiritual journey of learning about God and learning about his love and knowing how to walk in him. I don't know of anybody that isn't engaged with that conversation. It's just so cute. Few people have the opportunity to have it. Rituals, and we're going to sing old, tired choruses, that music they don't even relate to anymore or never did. We're going to sit there for a 45-minute lecture. Where else do kids sit through 45-minute lectures? Not even in the school classrooms anymore, even at the university
right
level. Those things are much more interactive now than they ever were. And so the pedagogy of a Sunday morning event in America, they say, is set to about the age of a kindergarten child. Stand up here, sit down here, sing this here, sit there. We're told what to do through the whole thing. That's no longer engaging to people who haven't been schooled in it and obligated to it. And I think this creates a great opportunity as to how do we live our relationship with Jesus in such a way that even the youth around me are engaged. And that begins, obviously, in our own home. That begins with the people that we know. It's not we need a program that engages him. We need a reality to Jesus and an authenticity of life that resonates with real people. And it will. It does all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because what I'm seeing is that what I love about the kids even is that they're relational. And then they want to talk about God.
Yep.
They're fine with that.
Yep.
But the jury's out. Okay, what do you do with them now? And of course, we do a lot of stuff like that and events and things like that. But yeah, I'm just real curious to see how this next generation is going to play out.
I am too. I think it'll be fun to see because I think no matter where you stand on the whole church stuff going on today, I think most people admit we are in a time of transition. The old ways are
right
not working.
Right.
And are we going to come up with new ways, which I may be part of it, or are we going to, some people want to do it. No, we've got to obligate kids back to the old ways. I mean, I had one guy in Germany say, you know, I drink out of this 500-year-old chalice every morning. This chalice has survived this war and that war, and World War II and World War I, and the saints have come into this, and kids need to be here. Drink this cup. And I'm like, dude, you're barking up the wrong tree. As powerful as that whole 500-year chalice may sound, you're not going to, that's your deal. That's not their deal.
Right.
So how are we going to find a way into their deal? Incarnation is always about meeting people where they are, not dragging people to where we think they should be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We had a great time. A couple, I think it was last weekend, we had a bike ride, eight guys, and three of us are brothers, and the rest weren't. And it was wonderful, just riding with them, talking with them, going out with them afterwards. It's awesome. I love it.
Yeah.
You know, to me, that's sort of evangelism. I just love doing that sort of thing.
Well, we'll find out authenticity is so compelling. That's what people don't realize. Artificiality is so empty, and you've got to obligate people to that. Authenticity, when people really live authentically, man, that's compelling.
Yep, right. You're a natural evangelist when you actually love something, and it shows when you live passionately. Exactly.
So,
Wayne,
let me ask you. So a group of people, and we are actually a group of people listening to you right now, but a group of people ask you, you're sitting in the room with them, and they say, Wayne, how do I look at my life now? How do I start to understand why I'm here, who I am, therefore my place in this world? In other words, some direction for my life. How do I start to look at that? How do I interpret my life? What do I do with that question? How would you answer that?
I'm going to throw it off on God, because I really think that's an individual journey more than a corporate journey. In other words, I get to encourage that journey for you, but I can't go on that journey for you. I can't even go on it with you. Sarah and I talk about in our marriage, for instance, that there's Sarah's journey and my journey, and then there's an us journey. There's the journey we share together. There's three journeys in this household. Sarah and I aren't always on the same page about things, but I want to be the biggest cheerleader on her God journey, on what God's doing in her. She gets to be the biggest cheerleader on my journey, what God's doing in me. And when that comes together in ways that are beautiful, then we have the shared journey. I think the same thing's true with a group of guys or a network of fellowship or whatever. Is, first of all, if I'm not having my own journey, if God and I aren't having this ongoing conversation about his love and freeing me to live in that love so I get disconnected from the selfish motives in my life, and where he's put me on the planet and where my passions lie, and I'm beginning to discover, if I'm not on that journey, no group is going to get me into that reality. So it is, at its heart, in my view, a very individual journey, and I can sit around with other brothers and encourage them to that journey. But I don't think there's anything corporate we can do to substitute for that journey. And if two or three of us in a group of people are on that journey, then when we come together, there's all kinds of cross-pollinating and seeing things together and encouraging each other and say, yes, 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 that does sound like Father to me, that we can do to help that journey be encouraged. But I tell people, the best I know, you have to wake up tomorrow morning if this is a journey you want to be on. And you begin to have that conversation with God. God, who have you made me to be in the world? God, if I don't know your love, will you show me your love? And where I know it, will you show it me in even more real ways? That is where this life takes hold in us. And I think we want to have it sometimes come from something external. So I can read a book, I can attend a meeting, and then I'm going to get it there. And not that those things are destructive, they can be helpful, but without that conversation between you and the Father, you're not going to begin to discover that.
Mm-hmm. So the way you are helping a person in their walk with God, right, to discover this is doing what?
Do I help someone else?
Yeah, when you say, what I want to do is help them understand it's their journey and help them in their journey with God.
Yeah.
How would you go about helping that person?
You know, that's going to be so individual to what that person is, what my relationship is with them. But it's going to have some sense of we're talking about God. We're sharing how God's making himself known. If he's not, I'm going to help equip people so they can begin to learn how to listen to him, how to kind of pick up on his heartbeat. If they're not secure in his love, how do I help them find that security that God loves them and that he's really committed to them. So it's going to be mostly conversations and mostly incredibly encouraging conversations, and we're going to pray together, and we're going to just going to have that. You know, I know people look for, you know, 3 points in a poem or 3 steps in a key or something. It really isn't rocket science. It really is simple as helping you have a conversation with God. And if you don't know how to have that conversation yet, then I hope my conversation with you reflects some of who God is. I have this little game I'm playing with my granddaughter now, which I take to her. Amy, I love you. And she goes, you do, Grandpa? I say, yeah, I love you all the time. And she goes, you can't, Grandpa. You can only love me one time. And she's just a contrarian, so we have these little funny things she plays. But I keep saying it to her because I know that's what the Holy Spirit is saying to her. I know in her little 6-year-old heart, God is always saying to her, I love you, Amy. I'm nuts about you. I want you to be my child. I love you. I say that to her. She playfully fights it because that's the nature of our relationship. We tease each other mercilessly. But I want to help people find that conversation with God by reflecting it in my conversation with them. And I think those are ways that you help people. And you got to put hope in their heart that this actually can happen for them. We have 2,000 years of history that has taught people you're incompetent for this. So until you get a Bible degree or until you become a sanctioned minister or qualified through a school, this stuff can't happen for you. And so part of it is that we got to poke that lie until it pops and really give people the hope that God wants to engage you. And he's already doing that. You may be missing it because you're not knowing where to look because you're looking in the wrong places, but he's already engaging you. Mm-hmm. And how do I help you have that conversation?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when a guy has left the institutional church, he sees it's become irrelevant for him. When does it, what's healthy and when does it become unhealthy if he's out there for a long time on his own?
That really depends on what's happening with him. Mm-hmm. If by being out there alone, quote unquote, I'm becoming more withdrawn, more isolated, more lonely, more preoccupied with my flesh, or more engaged with the distractions of life like football and weather and, you know, just sports and whatever, then you got to say probably not a healthy journey, probably not going a good place. I mean, those would be my indications. I always say whether you're in or out of an institution that matter to me so much, is your relationship, can you look back over 3 or 4 months and say, is this conversation growing between me and God?
Mm.
If it's not, then I have to ask myself, what's next? What do I need to think about here? If it is, then great. And I, you know, Paul seemed to have 2 or 3 years in the desert all by himself as God began to teach him. And Paul wasn't threatened by the fact that, oh, you know, I should be going to something every Sunday. But I do think he had a sense that this revelation is growing in my heart in this season of my life. So if it's a long season where you're alone, but God's just inviting you into something with him, I'm all good with that. Mm-hmm. So I guess we have to look at what's the outcome, what's the fruit of it. If it's more negativity and more getting lost, then I may have to take a look at what I'm doing. But if that relationship's growing and I'm learning to love others, then I'll soon be very connected to people around me, just out of the fruitfulness of that.
You know, Wayne, I remember a conversation I had with a good friend of mine who passed away years ago. His name is Brent Curtis, and he co-wrote the book The Sacred Romance. And
mm-hmm.
I remember him saying, he said, you know, the problem with this message is that it will spoil people for church. They'll go into church and they'll think, I can't go here. There's no life here. This is a different kingdom than what I've learned the kingdom of God is like. And it really was true. I mean, people were just going, I can't go back anymore. And so that created problems.
Yeah.
And then you've got this idea of, you know, what the law does, religiousness, the manipulation, the pressure, the conformity. And you put all those things together, and what I see is a common fallout today is what you guys talked about in your recent podcast, and that is betrayal, the being deeply hurt by another believer. And sometimes I think that hurt is so deep because in some cases the lives were so entwined with each other, you know, years of living together, and however many years there was true love for each other and doing life together, and then possibly, you know, manipulation and pressure and the things that you talked about in your podcast come out, and now there's this divide that is forced. And I see many, many people that are wounded so deeply, and it's just hard to get through that, where you kind of come back to yourself again. Yeah, I know that personally, so I just think what you talked about is huge, and I appreciate the fact that you were even reading some emails or letters that you've received on it, so I assume that's just a huge thing you're bumping into.
Well, it very much is, because I think because we've made so many of our quote-unquote church relationships a substitute for God relationships. In other words, I don't know who God is, I don't know how he works with me, so instead of sorting that out, I'm just going to try and let somebody else tell me what to do. That we really get wired to each other in unhealthy ways, and then when that relationship goes awry, the pain of that is just immense. And there's people that are willing, and there's so many people that are willing just to use people, whether it's to get their needs met or it's just their coping mechanism. They've had a very horrible past, and they cope with things by grabbing for everything they can get. And when they start to do that or fall back into that old pattern, it may be an old pattern from times before, it is very hurtful to the people who've walked alongside them and helped them. And I don't think there's anything that tests that quite like success. Success seems to be the big test of that. We can walk with each other in failure, and everybody's all good. And then when a certain amount of success in a ministry or success in something happens, then somebody wants to think it's all theirs and claim it. And that's where I think 90% of the betrayals I hear about from people grow out of some kind of successful thing that happened, and somebody just wanted to have it by themselves.
I love that line from the Jake book. I think it said, hey, a person who's suffering doesn't need accountability. A person who's successful, they need accountability. Right?
From the Shack?
Yeah. No, it's from the Jake book, I think.
Oh, the Jake book? No, we don't talk about accountability in a positive sense. Is that what you're
referring to? Well, I know that. But,
I made a quote.
Yeah, but just in that sense there, you know, it's the success where, you know, you should watch the guy. The hurting guy doesn't need accountability. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
the reality is hurting people hurt people. That's the reality. And the fix for that often is sometimes you just got to walk away. You just got to say, you know what, I deserve more than this, but I'm going to trust that God's taking care of me, so I'm not going to fight it out of you, and I'm just going to walk away. And there's a real grace in that where God, I mean, I've walked away from a number of things in my life that should have been more lucrative for me, should have been more attention-grabbing for me. But I don't find that God is always in the most money you can get or the most attention you can grab. In fact, I often find he's not in those places. And so when we don't choose to live there, I think we then find him in even more wonderful ways as our provider and as the one who opens doors for ministry that he desires for us, not what we have to do for ourselves. But that's a lot of trust.
Yeah.
Because we mostly get scared out of that.
Okay, so let me throw out this idea to everyone. We're about 8 minutes away from coming to the finish line on the call. So if you have a question, either raise your hand by pressing *2 or chat the question, and I'll ask it. But let me start with this question. So what you said, Wayne, was this idea that as a ministry gets big and successful, often the person thinks, it's me, I'm doing it, it's my ministry, and I don't want anybody to interfere with me in the success. And that just rings as so true. I mean, I've seen that over the years again and again and again. So I think the deepest question about that is not how do we handle that with other people, but how do we not let that happen to us? How do I not go there? How do you not go there to become that person?
Yeah, I wish I knew we were bright enough not to be. To me, if you're always willing to lay it down again, there's a podcast we did years ago with some brothers out of Ireland called Laying It Down in Dublin, and it really is, or Laying It All Down in Ireland, I think it might have been, but it's really their journey, 40 years of learning just what you just said, when you grab your life, you lose it, and when you lose it, for my sake, you'll find it. The only way we can not be those people is keep living inside such a security in my relationship with Jesus that I don't have to make you be my provider. I don't have to make you fulfill what you promised me.
Yeah.
I can walk away knowing God at the end of the day is going to make things right. And I don't even mean that God will get you. I don't mean that way. I just mean that what place God wants me to have in the world is going to come from God anyway, not you. And what resource I have at my disposal is going to come from God anyway, not you. So I've had brothers betray me in ministry and take everything for themselves because I was willing to give it up. And doggone, your willingness to give it up, they'll take it. They'll just absolutely take the whole thing. And I was pretty surprised by that. I was thinking, I'm willing to give it up, so now that'll really breed a willing to give it up in you too. And it doesn't. So then that's the challenge. and only if you're really secure, and I don't know that I am. That's why I say I don't know that I can waterproof myself here from doing this. I like to think I'm finding in my growing relationship with his Father, the more I find his love all that I want to live in, the easier it is to lay things down. And then yeah. I notice they've been in betrayals, how much love I have for the people who's betraying me. And I go, you know what? Hurting people hurt people. So, yeah, I could blame them. They're a horrible, cruddy person. They're unfaithful and they're lying, all that stuff. But the reality is they're broken inside. And because they're broken inside, now I become their whipping boy. And you know what? God's just bigger than that. God's just bigger than that. And I'm learning to find my peace there.
Mm-hmm. Gary, okay, are there any questions that
there's a question. Just came up. Mike asked this question. And he said, I love the article, quote, bait and switch. So my question is, if you are in the institutional church and God has called you to this place, how do you survive when you tell people you are walking away?
How do you, I think I missed the point. Can you reinterpret it for me? Is how do you tell people if you're walking away from that kind of thing?
Yeah, I assume, Mike McDay, that you are talking about the idea if you're walking away from the institutional church, that how do you let people know, how do you tell people what you're doing? And I'll tell you what, I'm going to take you off of mute, my friend. You're not going to make me ask this question.
Come on, Mike.
I'm not understanding it. So I'm going to find you here. 970.
Wayne, you'd love this guy. You have got to meet him sometime. He's a... Mississippi.
Oh, great. I was in Mississippi last year.
Okay, Mike, you are off mute, so why don't you ask the question better than I did?
It's because you didn't read the second piece of the chat.
Well, you didn't write it all correctly, so.
Whoa.
Go,
it's
my
good
friend.
Fight. I like it.
you know how us country guys from Mississippi do? It's broken English.
Okay, well, fix
I'm
the
not
English
going there.
And ask the question.
Wayne, I love the article that you wrote, Bait and Switch.
Yep.
It brought tears to my eyes the first time I read it, and I've actually read it about five times in the last 2 months. I work as a Christian counselor right now. So I have walked away from the institutional church, and I get asked by a lot of my clients that are Christians that go to church, where do I go to church? And I can tell when I tell them that I don't, that there is this almost like sorrow for me. And even some of the people that I work with in this building, they think I've lost my mind. So how do you deal with the pain of rejection that comes from people that just don't understand?
Well, you have to go to rejection practice.
I'm a counselor.
And it sounds to me like you're there.
How to do that piece, but it's still hard because you lose relationships.
I understand it's hard. I think one of the things that helps is by people not leaving stuff. I got an email the other day from some guy announcing he was leaving the institutional church to some group of email friends. So I'm going, why would you announce that? Seriously. I mean, if you feel like God's not had you there anymore, then just don't be there. And if people ask what you're doing, there's a number of great answers. You're saying, you know what, kind of between places, or I'm taking a sabbatical, or I'm going to want to live out my church life a little more relationally in these days. I mean, there's ways to answer it where most people go, huh, okay. And if they're more interested, they'll ask. I think the ways not to answer it is, well, you know what? It's not going to church. It's being the church anyway. And we kind of wave a red flag in front of people saying what you're doing is wrong, and that's why I've left it, and that's not ever helpful. But I think there's gentle ways just to tell people I'm trying something different. What's most important, I think, is we got wired to religion because we got wired to people's approval. And so when you don't get that approval anymore and you get what you say, what you describe as rejection – That's incredibly painful. I get that. The only way to overcome it is to be in it. It's just to not respond to it. It's to be gracious and patient with all men, as we're asked to do. Find a gracious answer that gives grace to them. Eventually, you will not define your journey by their assessment of your life. And when that happens, that's just where freedom really thrive. That's what Paul's saying in Galatians 1. If I wanted to be a bondservant, if I wanted to please men, I wouldn't be a bondservant of Jesus Christ. And it's so hard to follow God when you want people's approval. And it's so easy to follow him when you don't need it anymore. And that's what I think God will be doing. But he does it through the very kind of circumstance you're in. And it's hard to explain to people, and people reject you because of it. And you just go, you know what, I'm going to keep being loving to them. I'm going to try to help them understand that what I'm doing is not a judgment against what they're doing. I just feel like God's calling me to a little different thing right now. And most people will let you have that. They'll definitely have you for a season just to say, hey, I'm not sure what God's doing yet, or I'm just hungry for something more relational and just sitting there on a Sunday morning in the way I have been for a long time. And you give people room to be okay with what you're doing, even if they're not validating it. But eventually you won't care. Eventually, and I don't mean you won't care in kind of a rude, pompous way. I just mean their definition of you is not going to have any impact on anything in your heart, because that would be gone.
Mm. That's really good. Now, Deb asks this question, and she asks, what are the signs of coming back out of the desert?
Laughter is a great one. I'll tell you what, when you're in the desert, man, nothing's funny, everything hurts, and you laugh to hide, but genuine laughter, genuine joy, even. And I don't mean joy defined by circumstance. Anybody can be happy because, you know, somebody gave you $100,000. Anybody can be happy over that. I mean a resident joy, even in the garbage of your life, a sense that I'm not here alone, that I'm God is with me, and Jesus is my older brother. He's got things in his hands. And so I think laughter, joy in a real way, a sense of presence. I think most people define the wilderness as, you know, just there's no consciousness to God's presence. It's all by faith in my head. And I don't like that description of faith, to be honest with you, because I don't think faith is just trying to gut through something we can't see. But some of the signs are those. You're going to be a greater lightness. There's going to be greater color in the world because everything's not so heavy and everything's not so challenging. You're not laboring under this guilt or shame or condemnation. So when those things start to lift, I think it becomes evident.
Okay. Okay. Okay, I'm going to ask you a question that Chad wants me to ask you, and he's not getting on because his kids are decorating and it's noisy. So
hi,
I'm
Chad.
Ask us, and I'm going to hope that you understand the question because it feels like there's a context to it that I'm not aware of.
Okay.
He said, we were at Bread of Life for years with Tom and Barbara Moen and Chris and Linda Bush, it looks like, if I'm saying
I know
right.
Them both. They're dear, dear people.
Yeah.
Love them
okay.
Both.
It said, you spoke to them many times. That group was probably our first experience with a real fellowship that wasn't, quote, driven by agenda.
Yep.
Did you notice that when you came?
Yeah. I did. I mean, I noticed that, you know, by the time when that was very young, without I don't know a lot of the history, but I think when it was younger and it was more of the free flowing of a grace kind of thing and not a lot of conformity needs. And then when you get a big building, which they did, and then you start calling things in for a Sunday morning thing, and then a lot of people have ministries and gifts they want to use to berate other people over the head, and not even necessarily the leadership. I think Chris and Chris and his wife were out by then, but I do think other overlays get played out in that environment that make it more driven. But when I was there, and I think Tom is one of the most least driven guys on the planet that I know. I have thoroughly enjoyed my fellowship and touch with him. So
yeah.
I don't know all that it became afterwards. I know I just know when you have that much structure around you, people get good ideas and they're trying to get everybody else on the good idea with them, and then it can become a little bit of a pressure place. But I certainly don't know Chad's experience there, and my experience there has all been pretty positive, but I haven't spoke there a lot of times. I think I spoke there 3 times. But I have an ongoing friendship with Tom Moen that I deeply, deeply appreciate and love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Jeff, we are at the end of our time, and I know Wayne said he was getting hungry, so do you have another question?
You know, the only thing I was going to ask about is I love what you've done in the sense of, Wayne, this online community. I hear more and more people who tune into the God Journey, the God Journey, and listen in, and it's fun to meet them and talk with them. And what we're doing is a little bit of an online community here, especially for a lot of guys who might be out there on their own or just want to hook in with this. Do you have any suggestions for us on an online community and what the benefits are and what are some of the hooks that we need to watch out for?
Yeah, and I wouldn't call the God Journey an online community, so I guess I'm going to argue a little bit with the premise of your question, because the God Journey is such an extensive audience right now, and some of those people overlap in some blog comments. Our forum kind of blew up recently because we didn't police it and only let in people that were going to be healthy. So there's people who were throwing sand in the sandbox, and that got at other people just say who tried to help it be better but just gave up the fight. I tell you where the God Journey becomes a community is what you said. And when I travel around and a bunch of people come together who listen to that, who resonate with some of that content, mm-hmm. and I was just with a group up in the Central Valley this weekend. People came from 200-300 miles away and sat in a room together, and the rapport and the connection is instantaneous. But there's not a lot of proximity to it because of the distances. So I think the community for any of us, there's only so much you can do online. I think online is a valuable way to make connections. But unless you take that connection on, and it can be through Skype conversation, you can do that virtually mm-hmm. more than just – because the God Journey right now is mostly spectator. It's more of a Sunday morning thing in the sense that there's two guys doing all the talking mm-hmm. other than when we read some emails or whatever. We'd love to do that as a live thing, but we haven't figured out how to do it yet where people could call in and participate with us. But So I think for people to realize, hey, I find people who resonate with a common heart for God, then I'm going to pay the price to connect with those people. And there are people that, for instance, this weekend drove 200-300 miles to be part of what we were with. And I was in a home of some people just starting on this journey of living loved. And I love young couple family. I've got another family I know from that area, and I invited them to come. They live literally 5 miles away from where we were, but they just their weekend was complicated, and they just couldn't make it, and they didn't come. And it was just like, I'm sitting there going, see, dude, this is what you pay any price to be a part of. Mm-hmm. Now, I can connect them later, and I'm going to, because I think those families would really love to know each other. But to me, the real optimum time would have been there was a chance for me to be with people. And I know you guys do some retreats, and you do something like that. That's where real connections happen, is when you go face-to-face with people and you spend mm-hmm. 2 or 3 days together and you have some conversations. So I use online community very like my Facebook online community. I use it kind of tongue-in-cheek. Community is the face-to-face engagements with people, and that can be over great distances. I've got two brothers in Ireland carrying me through a very painful thing in my life right now, and they really, God's kind of put them alongside me. So we Skype every couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. We'll get on the face-to-face chat. And it's as rich a fellowship as if they were sitting in my room. But that's because I've been in their home. They've been in my home. We've built a relationship that goes beyond that so we can celebrate it virtually. And that's what I encourage guys to do. At some point, you've got to go face-to-face with people. You've got to have people in your home, go be in someone else's home, just find out what it is that really makes people tick and just how wonderful this fellowship can be.
Now, all the guys that we have in this base camp are guys that we have been through an intensive with where we've heard their story and know their journey a little bit. And then I think what the plan is that we just started it, but at least maybe every quarter have an event where everybody can gather up if they can make it. And so I think you're right. You have to spend 2 or 3 days with a guy. And once you make that face-to-face connection, it's so much easier to get back online with them. And just pick right back up on it, you know. So,
and what you'll find, too, is when you have relationships like that, they're a little more translocal, a little more distant, but you become settled in a good relationship, it's easier to connect more locally with people, even if they're not quite on the same page with you, even if they're still unbelievers. But to begin to have authentic friendships nearby, which are also a real joy. I mean, we do with our neighbors and people that live next to us, even though they're not believers yet. But we don't mind hanging out with them. We have them over for dinner. We have some fun. And we're engaging that relationship to see where God takes it. And that helps too. Once you have some two or three good solid ones, even if they're a bit of a distance away, it's easier to then risk what it takes locally to help that happen.
Yeah. Well, Gary, I've got another half hour worth of questions, so
we'll have to come back sometime.
You know,
we'll have to do this again then. Yeah,
we do. I remember, Wayne, when you talked about you were trying to get your life back to before you wrote The Shack, you know, and wanting that life back. I'd love to ask you that question. There's so many others, and so maybe we'll do this again sometime. But, you know, I just want to say something about your life, Wayne, that I love, and that is that you just didn't write the book and hold up in your living room and took the proceeds. You know, when I saw you here, you looked for the people who were hurting and needed an answer, and you and Sarah sought them out and sat down with them, and you didn't even just do the talks. You just spent time with them and wanted to pray with them, and I watched that, and I loved that, and so thank you for your life and what you've done for the kingdom, bro.
You're welcome.
Yeah, Wayne, thank you. This has been a huge treat for me. I mean, I've written so many notes down, and I'm definitely going back to re-listen to this, and it's just been so good to hear you and for you to respond to these things. Thank you.
You're welcome. Appreciate it. And Gary, I hope our paths cross sometime. I'd love to sit down and share together someday.
I hope so, too. I would love to do that. So
right,
thank you, Wayne. Thank you, Jeff, for doing this. And thanks for everybody for being on.